Yokanon playing Nicanor.
Yeah, it was an interesting
The reading
find.
we've done around that, I've never come across that. I found it particularly interesting, and I hadn't followed it through any further, but unlike Hollywood movies where the heroes always, you know, come out victorious at the end,
Right.
they did come out victorious, but at least two of the brothers died in the process.
Yes. Right, Eliezer, and I think Yochanan.
Yeah.
See, my interest in that was that, you know, when you have a book like the Megillus Esther, or you have something which is committed, I guess, collection of what is considered written Torah, so then we analyze it with a great amount of analysis, because we have appreciation that if this is written down as part of written Torah, Torah Shebiksav, so then it finally inspired. So there's a tremendous amount of wisdom to be derived. Being that this one is not, so the question is whether or not it still contains some great insights. So that's why I wanted to look over it again and to discuss what maybe the key points are being brought up in that are about.
I see.
Let's see if we have to underline that and then take that up for analysis after we finish reading it. Okay, so the story is, I'm going to read it verbatim. It was in the days of Antiochus, king of Greece, great and mighty places, and their temples he burned with fire, and their men he imprisoned in jails. From the days of Alexander the king, meaning Alexander the Great, there arose no king like him on all sides of the river. And he built a great city on the seashore to be his house of kingdom, and Antiochus called the city by his name. And also his second in command, Bagris, built another city next to it, and Bagris called it by his name. And so its name was until his day. In the 23rd year of his reign, it was the 13th year of the building of the temple, he gave face to ascend to Jerusalem. So he decided to take over Jerusalem. Now, what was the reason? And he answered, or he responded, and he said to his officers, quote, "Do you not know that there is a Jewish people in Jerusalem among us? To our God they do not sacrifice, and our religion they do not practice, and the king's decrees they forsake to do their religion. And they also hope for the day of dethroning of the kings and rulers. And they say, when will it end, and the entire world will be given to our hand?" End quote. So he's saying this is the charge that he's now lodging against the Jews, that they desire the ruin of all other kings, and that they do not follow their gods, and the religion they don't follow. Well, to the kingdom, to leave is not honorable to the kingdom, to leave them be on the face of the earth. So his charges are based on not a personal type of attack. It was the same type of approach as Haman did, animosity towards Mordechai alone, because Mordechai didn't bow or didn't even move when Haman would come into the room, and there was a decree that was sanctioned by Ahasuerus that everybody should bow to Haman, and Mordechai did not do so. And he also didn't even flinch when Haman would come into the room. So this really bothered Haman to a great amount, but he realized politically that you can't just trump up charges against one person because it seems too petty. So he formulated a whole argument against the people that they're not the same, and the Talmud talks about how he says if the king or would touch a glass of wine of a Jew, he'd spill it out on the ground. But if a fly would land in the glass of wine of a Jew, he would take the fly out and continue drinking. So he studied a bit about the Jewish laws and used that against the Jews. Ultimately, his aim was to exterminate Mordechai, but he realized that his plan wouldn't fly unless he showed there was some sort of a problem with the kingdom. See, here also, Antiochus says to the people, it is not honorable to the kingdom to leave them be on the face of the earth, people, not just for himself. And now let us come and we'll ascend onto them and nullify the tree that was cut with them concerning the Sabbath, the new moon, and circumcision. Now keep that in mind, because why was these three issues? Why were these three issues what Antiochus used as an additional justification? And what was bothering him regarding those three? Again, it's Sabbath, the new month, and circumcision. So after he delivered this speech to his officers, he goes on, and the matter was good in the eyes of his officers and in the eyes of his entire army. At that time, Antiochus the king arose, and he sent Nicanor, his second, with a great army and many people, and they came to the city of Judah, to Jerusalem. And they slaughtered a great slaughter and built an altar in the temple, in the place where the God of Israel said to his servants, his prophets, where I will cause to dwell my manifested presence eternally, end quote. In that place, they slaughtered the pig, and they brought its blood to the sanctified courtyard. So they basically defiled the temple. And as this occurred, when Yochanan, son of Matasiahu, the high priest, heard these doings had occurred, he was filled with anger and rage, and the countenance of his face changed, and he counseled in his heart what should be done on this. And then Yochanan, son of Matasiahu, made himself a sword, 2 spans long and 1 span wide, covered under his clothing. And he came to Jerusalem and stood in the gate of the king, and he called to the gatekeepers, and he told them, quote, I am Yochanan, son of Matasiahu. I have come before Nicanor, end quote. And then the gatekeepers and the watchmen came and told him, the high priest of the Jews stands in the opening, meaning they were telling Nicanor that the high priest of the Jews is waiting to speak to him. And Nicanor answered and said to them, let him surely enter. Then Yochanan was brought before Nicanor, and Nicanor answered and said to Yochanan, quote, are you one of the rebels that rebels against the king and desires not the peace of the kingdom, end quote. And Yochanan answered before Nicanor and said, quote, I am he, now I come before you, that which you wish I will do. So he was playing a game, but to get in with the private chambers of Nicanor. Nicanor answered and said to Yochanan, if as my will you will do, take a pig and slaughter it on the altar, and robe in the king's clothing, and ride of the king's horses, and as one of the king's beloved you will be. So he set up conditions in order that he can get the leader. And as Yochanan listened, he responded a thing. He said back to Nicanor, to be loyal to him, and he said, quote, my master, I fear from the children of Israel. Perhaps they will hear I have done so, and they will stone me with rocks. Now let all men leave from before you. Perhaps they will make the matter known. So Yochanan was saying, here. So he was making believe he was agreeing. So then Nicanor fell for Yochanan's plan, and he believed that he was telling the truth. So Nicanor caused all the men to leave from before him. At that moment, Yochanan, son of Matasiahu, lifted his eyes to the heavens and assembled his prayer before God. And he said, quote, my God and God of my fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, please do not give me into the hand of this uncircumcised, because if he will kill me, he will go and praise in the house of Dagon, his God, and say, my God has given him into my hand. So at that moment, Yochanan stepped towards him 3 steps and plunged the sword that he had hidden under his garment into Nicanor's heart, and he threw Nicanor's corpse into the sanctified courtyard. Before the God of heaven, Yochanan answered and he said, my God, do not place on me sin that I have killed in the sanctified area. Now, so also give all the people that come with him to pain Judah and Jerusalem, meaning let all other people die the same way. Then Yochanan left, the son of Matasiahu, on that day, and warred with the people and slaughtered in them a great slaughter. The number of the slain that he slayed on that day was 72,700 that were killed altogether. So they were very successful in their first attack of Hus officer and Nicanor.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Does that imply that he did that single-handedly, or that he garnered the rest of his troops to do it?
It would seem almost impossible for one person to accomplish. I had the same question because it does not say how many were with him. But it would seem for a person to accomplish that, it doesn't give a time frame. In case, that itself would be a miracle, especially if it was done in such a short period of time.
Yeah.
So on Yochanan's return, they built a pillar on his name and called it Maccabee Killed the Mighty, which seems to imply that he did do something single-handedly here, unless they're just saying that he was the leader. And it was that King Antiochus heard that his second-in-command, Nicanor, was killed, and it grieved him much. And he sent to bring Bagris, the wicked, that misled his people. And Antiochus answered and said to Bagris. So Bagris was another one of his commanders. And he said to Bagris, do you not know, have you not heard what the children of Israel have done? They killed my army and looted my camp and my officers. Now on the money you are trusted, on the houses and their houses are yours. Come and descend upon them and nullify the treaty which was cut with them. And he says again, come and descend upon them and nullify the treaty which was cut with them by their God concerning Sabbath, the new month, and circumcision. All right, so the same 3 items again. Then Bagris the wicked and all his camp came to Jerusalem and slaughtered in them a great slaughter, and decreed a complete decree on Sabbath, the new month, and circumcision. When this occurred, that the matter of the king was urgent, there was found a man who circumcised his son, meaning he was violating Antiochus's decree. So they brought the man and his wife, and they hung the man in front of the child. And also the woman who bore the son, after her husband died and circumcised him at 8 days, she went up to the walls of Jerusalem and her circumcised son in her hands. And she answered, she called out, and she said to Bagrus the wicked, you intend to nullify from us the treaty that was cut with us. The treaty of our fathers will not be nullified from us concerning Sabbath, the new moon, and circumcision. From our children's children, it will not be removed. So she denied any type of compliance with the decree. And she dropped her son to the ground, and she fell after him, and they both died together. So they committed suicide. Well, she did, and caused the baby to die as well. And many of the children of Israel did similarly in those days, and they did not veer from the treaty of their fathers. At that time, the children of Israel said, either this way or that way, let us go and rest in the cave, lest we desecrate the Sabbath day. And they slandered them before Bagrus. So they told, I guess, Bagrus about these people that were going to flee and not comply with the Sabbath. So they went to a cave. Then Bagrus the wicked sent men girded for battle, and they came to the opening of the cave and said to them, come out to us, eat of our bread and drink of our wine, and our actions you shall do. And the children of Israel answered, either way, we remember what God commanded us on Mount Sinai. 6 days you shall work and do all your labor, and on the seventh day rest. Now it is better for us that we die in this cave than desecrating the Sabbath day. When this happened, the Jews did not come out to them. They brought wood and burnt it at the opening of the cave, and there died approximately 1,000 men and women. All right, so again, the question would be here, you know that there are three cardinal sins that a person must die for, a Jew must die for. You, so then the person has to suffer death. You're not allowed to kill a person or commit adultery. Then even if a person tells you, eat this pig or else I'll kill you. So normally, if it's done privately, you'd have to eat the pig, and you should live by, because the Torah says, v'chai b'hem, you should live by the laws. And the rabbis derive, yes, you should live by them and not die, and you should not die by them. That means that, and also they say by Shabbos, you should violate one Shabbos if a person, let's say, his life is at risk. So they say, if violate one Shabbos, whatever you have to do, drive in the car, take him to the hospital, in order that you can fulfill many other Sabbaths in the future. So it makes sense. Here you're trying to retain life so you can have a good life and fulfill the Torah on a longer, you know, a longer lifespan. However, when it comes to either idolatry, adultery, or murder, there the sin is so grave that you have to suffer death as opposed to committing those crimes. Or if oppressors would come to a Jew publicly and tell him to eat this because they want him to violate Judaism, and they do it publicly, and they say, eat something not kosher. So normally you can eat something not kosher to save your life. If you're in the desert and you have no food, you could, and you find a snake, so you would eat it to save your life, even though it's not kosher, because there the prohibition is removed. But it's not removed when it is being done in order to, for a person to the principles publicly. Now, did these people do the right thing or not? So we'll have to come back to that and see if they're proper in their actions. Afterwards, and let's go back to the story. Afterwards, there came out 5 sons of Matasyahu, Yochanan and his 4 brothers, and they warred with the people and slaughtered a great slaughter and drove them to the isles of the sea because they trusted in the God of heaven. Then Bagrus entered one ship and fled to King Antiochus, and with him were men, escapees of the sword. And Bagrus answered and said to King Antiochus, you, the king, placed a command to nullify from the Jews the Sabbath, the new moon, and circumcision, a great deceit and rebellion in its midst. There, Doug, it seems to be that these 5 were alone. Because he's saying, he's specifying just the 5 sons. And Bagrus continues further. He says, from lions they are stronger, and from eagles they are more swift, and from bears they are more quick. So evidently, Bagrus is saying, these 5 against us, we just couldn't overpower them. So Bagrus continued, and he said, now, king, I offer you good counsel, and do not war with few men. For if you war, you will be embarrassed in the eyes of all kings. Therefore, write and send books in all cities of your kingdom, that there come officers of war, and not leave one of them, and also elephants wearing armor with them. And the matter was good with the king Antiochus, and he sent books to all cities of his reign, and there came officers of all the people and kingdoms, and also elephants wearing armor came with them. And Bagrus the wicked arose and came to Jerusalem. He broke the wall and cut off the water supply, and he broke in the temple 13 breaches, and also from the stones he broke until they were like dust. And he thought in his heart and said, quote, this time I will not be overtaken because of the numbers of my army and might of my hands, end quote. Yahu heard, they arose and came to Mitzpah Gilead, that was the name of the place. They decreed a fast and sat on ashes to seek out mercy from before God of heaven. Then there fell good counsel in their hearts. Judah the firstborn, Simon the second, the third was Yochanan, the fourth Jonasan, and the fifth Elazar. And their father blessed them, and he said to them, Judah, my son, I liken you to Judah, the son of Jacob, who was equated to a lion. Simon, my son, I liken you to Simon, son of Jacob, who killed the inhabitants of Shechem. Yochanan, my son, I liken you to Avner, son of Ner, officer of the army of Israel. Jonasan, my son, I liken you to Jonasan, son of Saul, who killed the Philistine people. Elazar, my son, I liken you to Pinchas, son of Elazar, who was jealous for his God and saved the children of Israel. On this there went out the five sons of Matathiah on that day, and warred with the people, and slaughtered them a great slaughter. And there was killed from them Judah. So Judah, one of the brothers, died at that point. At that moment, when the sons of Matathiah saw that Judah was killed, they returned and they came to their father. And they said to, and he said to them, meaning the father said now back to the remaining four sons, why have you returned? And they answered and they said, on account that our brother was killed, who was equated to all of us. And Matathiah their father answered and said to them, I will go out with you, and I will fight with the people, lest the house of Israel perish. And you are frightened on your brother. And Matathiah went out on that day with his sons and fought with the people. And God of heaven gave all the mighty of the nations into their hands, and they slaughtered a great slaughter, all who seized the sword, and all who drew the bow, officers of war, and the seconds in command. There was not left one remnant, and there fled the rest of the people to the cities of the sea. And Elazar was involved in killing the elephants, and he was submerged by the chariots of the elephants. And when they returned, they looked for him and found, and they looked afterwards, they found him that he was submerged by the chariots of the elephants. And the children of Israel were gladdened that there was given to their hands their enemies. From them they burned with fire, and from them they pierced with the sword, and from them they hung on trees. And Bagrus, the wicked that misled his people, the children of Israel burned him with fire. And then Antiochus the king heard that Bagrus the wicked was killed, and all officers of war with him. He entered into a ship and fled to the cities of the sea. And it was that each place he came to there, they mocked him and called him the runaway. Afterwards, the children of the Hasmoneans came to the temple, and they built the broken gates, and they closed the breaches, and purified the courtyard from the casualties and from the impurities. And they searched for pure olive oil to light the candelabrum, and they did not find but one canister that had the seal of the ring of the high priest. And they knew that it was pure, and it contained a measurement to light for only one day. And God of heaven, who caused to dwell his name there, gave a blessing, and they lit from it 8 days. The reason why, parenthetically, it lasted for 8 days was that was the time that they needed to press new oil. Before they established the children of the Hasmoneans a fulfillment, and they forged a law, and the children of Israel with them as one, to make these 8 days days of drinking and happiness, as the appointed days written in the Torah, and to light on them lights to make known what was done to them by the eternal God of heaven. And on them one may not eulogize nor decree fast days or have a fast, except if it was accepted on it prior to this day, and pray before the God. The Hasmoneans and their children and their brothers, they did not decree on them to nullify service of work. And from that time there was no name to the kingdom of Greece. And there received the kingdom, the children of Hasmoneans and the grandchildren from that time until the destruction of the temple, 206 years. Therefore the children of Israel from that day and all their exiles guard these days and call them days of drinking and gladness from the 25th day of Kislev, 8 days. From that time and eternally there should not be removed from them that were in the temple, priests, Levites, and their wise men who established upon them and upon the grandchildren eternally. Okay, so that concludes the account, the Megillas Antiochus.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Go back to 59.
Yes.
Where Matathiah says, I will go out with you and I will fight with the people lest the house of Israel perish, and you are frightened on your brother.
Right.
Do we have any sense of what that last clause means?
It seems to be that this is why they returned earlier, because they saw that Judah, who was equated to all of them, was killed. And now this puts some pangs of fear in them. Evidently, they were with them. So Matathiah said to them, I will fight with you because this seems to be you're unnerved by the fact that your brother was killed. And he says, and you are frightened on your brother, meaning the fear came because there was a certain sense maybe of, not invincibility, but this confidence that came, I guess, from the five brothers was broken by the greatest one being killed.
I see.
So he felt that now the way to
repeat and really to strengthen their resolve.
Exactly.
Not a rebuke.
Right. Now, maybe it was also because he saw that they came back to him. That fact that they came back to him displayed what? Why did they return to the father after Judah was killed?
It seems to me that they felt like they were without leadership.
Right. And evidently their father saw that. And he saw that the war was vital, and he saw clearly that if you're coming, Matasyahu was saying to himself, that I see that my four sons have come back to me because their confidence has been broken, and if they're coming back to me, that means they've right exactly. So they're going back to regain some sort of a security. When he saw that they now viewed him in such a light. Just like they viewed Judah, he realized the only thing he could do is now take over Judah's place. So their actions of returning to the father after Judah was killed showed Matasyahu, the father, that they transferred their sense of confidence from Judah onto him. So now Matasyahu, understanding that, now realized that he has to now step in because of the display of their reliance on him.
I see. Thank you.
Right. Okay, so now let's see the questions that we had. And you'll notice also he says at the end of the story, why was the holiday established? The holiday was established subsequent to the oil. And now let me read you something from Maimonides, which complies with this. This is in his Laws of Hanukkah. I'll read you the first three laws, just to give you the background. It's not too long. He says, in the second temple, when the Greeks... to the temple, and they made many breaches, and they made impure that which was pure, and they grieved Israel very much, and much pain did they give them, until God or their fathers had mercy on them and saved them from the hands and gave them salvation. And then the sons of the Hasmoneans had become victorious, the Kohanim, the great Kohanim, the great priests, and they killed of the enemies, and they saved Israel from their hands. And they established a king from the priests, and they returned the kingdom to Israel more than 200 years until the second destruction of the temple. And now that's the first law. The second law, and this is in Laws of Hanukkah, 3:1-3, we're going to read. So that was the first one. That was 3:1. 3:2 reads as follows. And when the Jews were victorious on their enemies, and they destroyed them, it was the 25th of the month of Kislev. And they entered into the temple, and they did not find any oil that was pure in the temple, except for one canister. But there was not sufficient amount to light except for one day. But they lit it, and a miracle occurred where it lasted 8 days, until they can press new oil and bring out oil from it. And law three, he says as follows. And because of this, the rabbis established in that generation, that there should be 8 days, that these 8 days that they began on the 25th of Kislev, days of gladness and singing praise to God, and lighting candles in the evening on the door openings of the houses. Every single night of the 8 days, in order to display rabbis, just like reading that they established the holiday, as opposed to what? What else could have they established a holiday on?
The army.
Right.
Succeeding.
Right, but they didn't. Okay, but in terms of them establishing the holiday, they did not do that until the miracle of the oil. I mean, right now, additionally, there was no need for any miracle at this point. They were already completely victorious over their enemies. Right. But that could have happened even without the miracle of the oil. I mean, there's a principle in Jewish law, which in Hebrew is onus rachmana patre. In English, that means that if a person has been forced or coerced into a situation and his violation of the law, or he couldn't fulfill something. In this case, they couldn't fulfill lighting the menorah. Let's say there was no miracle of the oil. So it wasn't their fault. They'd have to wait 8 days to press new oil, and then they would start to relight the menorah, the candelabrum, which was the daily activity. They light it in the morning and clean out the ashes every evening. But if you can't do that because your enemy just destroyed the temple and defiled all the oil, so you are not to blame. And there's a complete exemption for the inability to fulfill that positive command because it was not your own doing. If a person's negligent and just decides, I'm not going to pray to God today when you're supposed to pray every day, so then that's something with that negligence is attributed to the person. But if a person was bound and gagged and he didn't have a sitter, a prayer book in front of him, so then it's not his fault that he can't pray, and there's no sin on his hands. So the Jews also, it wasn't their fault that there wasn't enough oil there. So why was it necessary to make a miracle that the oil should last so long? What was the need for that? And also, why didn't they establish the holiday just based on the fact that they won the war?
Establish the holiday because of the miracle, not just...
Well, Maimonides says that after the oil lasted for 8 days miraculously, he says, and because of this, they established.
Seems to make it different than sometimes you can't tell exactly when God is acting in a situation because he acts within the natural laws of things, and everything up to this point, while it looks miraculous to us in retrospect, could have been, you know, explained by natural laws, but that once they saw the miracle, they realized Hashem's hand in the entire process.
Exactly. Right. You hit the nail on the head. Because you could explain things naturally up to this point. But once the oil, which according to natural law had to be consumed in 1 day and it lasted 8 days, that was a clear demonstration by God that his hand was in it. And that was a clear instruction to the rabbis. They understood this to mean that this is something which now has to be commemorated. Right. So God wished that this event now be commemorated. Now the question would be is what was so significant about this event, the war, as opposed to other cases? I mean, there were only two holidays that were instituted after the Torah was received, and that was Hanukkah and Purim.
That's true, and we read in the Tanakh of all kinds of wars where it was obvious that God intervened on behalf of the Jews, and they didn't set up a permanent celebration to commemorate it.
Right.
Special about this one. That, if I'm trying to draw a parallel with the story of Esther, is it that it's a very clear situation where the Jews were downtrodden, turned back to Hashem, and Hashem stepped in and saved them?
I mean, you have that in numerous cases.
Yeah, I suppose that's true more than just Esther and Hanukkah. It can't be just because of the miracle of the oil, because you didn't have that in Esther.
It's a common thread between Purim and Hanukkah, that it's the same reason?
Either that, or they have their own significance that outshines any other case where there was a salvation.
I'm wondering if it has anything to do with the temple. Because the temple only stood when God was present with the Jews, and the fact that they rose up to get it back again when it was...
Or if you postulate that that Hashem's presence was pulled away, which would be presumably because Antiochus and his crew were allowed to go in and defile the temple. Then the Jews stepped in and kind of stepped up to the plate and were able to, if you will, affect Hashem's re-presence through their actions.
Do you want to say that the temple...
Hey, we're on the right track.
I don't know. I'm thinking a lot, too, because I'm just pondering this question. I mean, in the past, the way I had approached it is that, you know, for example, there was a time where the Jews were fighting, Joshua prayed to God to stop the sun and moon. And they did so. And they succeeded. You know, God did so. He stopped the sun and the moon, and they were victorious. And that was an amazing miracle. But there was no holiday instituted for that. And I always responded that, well, that was because it was for the need of the war. It was purely a military need. But by Hanukkah, like you said, Doug, it was subsequent to the war. There was the victory was there already. And then a miracle took place. So that now underlined the reason why they should establish it. So that tells them that they should establish the holiday. It's not telling us what significance this event had over others. Now, Rabbi Chait had once explained that the reason why you only have Hanukkah and Purim is because they address the two head categories of danger. One is the loss of physical life. That was by Purim, when the Haman wanted to exterminate the Jews. And here, the Greeks were not trying to exterminate, but they were trying to Hellenize them. So here they just wanted to convert their religion. That's why they had brought the pig in the temple. They wanted to denigrate the whole Jewish religion, and they wanted the Jews to follow them. So the only two type of categories where they established a holiday was when there was the risk of annihilation or the risk of losing Judaism from the people. Salvation for the nation is something which warranted, you know, that scale. I guess we also have to put into the mix that it was because of that scale of risk that so the whole nation was saved, so it demanded a response of a yearly commemoration. Question. I hear what you're saying about the temple. They did repentance. So these are two cases that came back and showed that he will, you know, reenact, or as you said, Doug, it, to effectuate his providence again after a lapse. So it teaches that even if we get into the most dire straits, that if we return, there is the concept that God forgives and he atones and he'll help out again, just like at the beginning. I'm not denying what you're saying, Cal, about that here there was the element of the temple in both cases. Is right afterwards, in Esther's time also, they established the rebuilding of the temple. And here was the re-inauguration. And it could be as well when the risk of the entire nation, and that's what these two cases were, maybe there was not a risk of the entire nation in Joshua's days. But here it was lost from the people, like in this time of the Hanukkah. So it was on such a grand scale. I can't really say definitively, but let's just take up one other question I mentioned at the beginning, unless you have any comments or questions.
No, please proceed.
It says a number of times that with Antiochus, the charges he laid against them was that they're not following our religion, and they can't wait for the day for where their king's rule, and he says, let us nullify their covenant of the Sabbath, the new month, and circumcision. Let's see if we can understand why those three elements is what Antiochus was attacking.
Wouldn't he want to nullify the new month because that's where all the festivals get measured from, and so it would be impossible for them to keep the festivals?
Somebody mentioned, I don't know if they were so savvy to know that the new month is something to all the holidays. It could be. But even so, why was the festival something which was disturbing to Antiochus? Why is that disturbing to another religion?
Circumcision is a way that it keeps them sort of physically separate from the other people.
Right.
And I suppose Sabbath is too, because no one keeps the Sabbath except the Jews. So this was a way, a very overt way of preventing Antiochus from having his dream of everybody's under his one religion kind of approach.
Right. Exactly. Because he was disturbed by those elements which segregated the Jew from everybody else. So, circumcision was one clear distinction. And their absence of works, that the physical bodies had a distinguished mark, as well as their actions, the one day a week and the holidays, you could say together, also showed the means of their actions. So their bodies and their actions had to be brought under his wings, and he wanted to camouflage any type of distinction that they had. So prohibiting the circumcision would make them more like him, and canceling out the holidays and Shabbos. It's interesting. I remember Rabbi Chait once giving a class and talking about it when Joseph was in power in Egypt. So they had come to him for, you know, they were running out of grain, and he had all the answers and told them how to do it. And they tried to store the grain in one type of soil, and it all rotted. And when Joseph was able to take the grain and store it another way, it stayed fresh. So once Joseph told the Egyptians to circumcise themselves. So they came to Paro, and they said, Joseph is telling us to circumcise ourselves. So Paro said, well, when he told you to do this, to, you know, prepare the grain a certain way, and you didn't, so loss at your hands. So listen to him about this too. The question was, though, why was Joseph telling them to circumcise themselves? So Rabbi Chedid had suggested that there seemed to have been a power play that Joseph was involved in, and he'd never really got the Egyptians to follow him wholeheartedly. And he was trying to get them to identify with him, because evidently they found out that he was circumcised. And a lot of people at the outset knew that he was a Hebrew, even though that Paro tried to gloss that over by changing his name and giving him a wife that was Egyptian, and to give him the veneer as an Egyptian. Nonetheless, the Egyptians still did find out that he was circumcised. And Joseph knew that this was now causing a lack of identification, and it was or breaks identification. So here as well, it was had to be removed. They could not continue doing the circumcision because that kept them segregated. So it's interesting how that issue comes up. It reappears. And actually, the reappearance was here, because this is a later date than Joseph. Okay, so that's good. Let's see if we can answer another question. Why do you think the miracle was that evidently God wanted the Jews to understand that his hand was in the war and that he saved their lives? So he made a miracle which was unnecessary for the salvation, to underline the fact that now it must be that he's telling us that the fact he does a miracle now, which is not even necessary for our salvation because we're already victorious, but he must want us to reflect on the whole event. But why was the miracle the expressed in the oil lasting 8 days? Or let's say a more general question. Why was the miracle of Hanukkah, maybe one of the reasons, maybe see if we could answer, why God selected the oil to be the medium through which he would make a miracle?
My thought on this is that the light that's given through the menorah is a metaphor, in a sense, for how the Jews were supposed to be the light to the nations. And through the Jews, well, it's manifested through God, but the Jews are sort of the instrument of that light. light.
Okay, I would agree with the metaphor. I would still, in terms of the approach, to try to get more of a literal understanding before going to metaphor. Did the rabbi say that any in Hebrew it's in mikriot yodim de pshuta, which means that as well, and that I would say is first and foremost. So, what was the oil used for?
Light, heat, and cooking.
Well, in the temple.
The temple. Just to keep the candle lit.
Right. It was keep the candelabra. That was one of the laws. And if you want, I did an article a while back on the temple. You could find it where I explain one approach, at least, as to what the vessels in the temple were for, what the concepts were related to each one. And the menorah itself, which has seven branches, seven always harkens back to creation, 7 days of creation. And to remind us that which God are we relating to? The God that rested on the seventh day. If we are ever asked by another nation, what is our definition of God? We say it's the creator of heaven and earth, the one that rested on the seventh day. That's why the first prayers in the morning, we say the opening words are, blessed be the one who spoke and the world came into being. So the first thing we do each morning when we pray is to remind ourselves, because every person has idolatrous feelings, idolatrous emotions that can press forward. And it's a vital thing. It's a vital element of Judaism that we have a constant reaffirmation of our concept of God. However little it is, it has to be, first and foremost, the creator. And the menorah has seven branches. It never seemed to imply that creation. The 6 days and the seventh day that God rested. And again, like we're saying, that the first prayer we say in the morning is, blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into existence. Concept of the temple, which is recognition of God and, of course, worship of God. It's being that we're created and he gave us a mission, this is exactly why we're here. So temple embodies the concept of man's subservience to God. But before we can have the concept of subservience to God, we must have the concept of what do we mean by God. So when they went in and they wanted to reinaugurate temple worship, so it could be that God selected the oil because this was the first act that they sought to do in terms of reaffirmation of the system. The system was now at risk. That's what the Greeks were trying to do, is to eradicate Judaism, was to Hellenize the Jews. And their attempt now to reinaugurate the temple and to do this worship was the correct act, and God wanted to underscore that concept. And perhaps with the most primary concept of temple, and that is that the God that we relate to is the one who created heaven and earth and rested on the seventh day. That's just a suggestion as to what why oil might have been what was used. But as well, like you said, Cal, I mean, the concept of it being light, yes, that is. There's open verses that the rabbis associate light with the Torah. There's actually a statement that says, for a flame is a command, and Torah is light. A flame is a command, but Torah is light. What do you think they mean by that? Why is a flame only a command, but Torah is light?
Person cannot make light per se. The only thing they can fulfill as far as a commandment is to make a flame.
Why can't I make light with a lot of flames? What do you mean?
You can make physical light, but you can't make light into truth. Whereas the Torah lights up everything, the hidden most things and the world of ideas.
So what is the comparison in the verse for a light is a mitzvah, is a single command, but the corpus of Torah a flame is akin to a single command, meaning a single candle is compared to a single command, but the entire Torah is compared to light.
Well, I suppose if we use the physical analogy, if a flame is a command, is like lighting one candle, so that's a command. But if you take all the Torah's commandments and put them all together and light all of that, you have a huge amount of light.
Okay. I would just take that one step further and suggest that although a single command is a light, there is some element, like to get back to what Cal was mentioning, illumination. Nonetheless, there is an entire system, and without doing the entire system, you don't really have the real full-blown light that we're really looking for. I mean, a complete understanding, to be able to have an illuminated day where you can do your work and so on, you need light. You can't just have a single flame. So similarly, in order to have the true good of the Torah system, it has to be where all commands are upheld, not just a single one. A single one has its place. But there is an objective of all individual mitzvos. And if any are left out, the system becomes corrupt. I was talking with an individual who we're in contact with when a person is kills by accident. So the issue came up in Maimonides that if a Gentile kills by accident or breaks any of the seven Noahide laws, so then their lives are terminated. They are killed. They suffer the penalty of death. If a Jew kills somebody only by purpose, then he's also killed as well. But if he kills by accident, so then he has to go to the cities of refuge. And we're trying to understand what was the difference. I mean, all human beings, God wants all of us to have the same perfection. And we say it every day. I mean, a Jew davens, or if anybody davens, but I'm just saying a Jew because a Jew is obligated in davening, in praying. So we look forward to the day where all people of flesh will recognize God. So that's God's objective, that everybody should recognize God. And we said it many times, that he did not create the religions. Man created religions. God created men and women, that men and women should equally have perfection. Judaism was not to select out one religion and God discarded everybody else. The plan was, these are the people that started out with monotheism, so I'll give them the system, but they will now be the luminaries for the rest of the world to teach. So the question is, if that's so why is it that there is a more grave punishment for a Gentile who breaks any one of the seven commands, even kills by accident? So I suggested, because in accordance with what Rabbi Chait had explained once, that the system of the Noahide laws are a minimal system, meaning this: if a person can't keep at least these seven laws, which they're primarily all basic to any person with intelligence, if they cannot be upheld, that means the whole purpose of life in that individual is lost. This is the smallest amount of laws that you must keep. So, it's not to say that killing is any worse for a Gentile than for a Jew in terms of the person who's killed, but it does represent that there has to be. Meaning, even if a Gentile would steal a penny, that would be punishable with death. So it's not just, Aurora, I'm addressing you on this as well right now, that it's not just the killing accidentally that a Gentile would be killed for, but even stealing, any type of a breach in that minimal system. This is what entitles a person to life. They must keep these seven. And I don't think it would be any different for a Jew who didn't keep these seven. We even say that we don't give charity. There's a question, Doug, that I addressed to you, that you were asking about charity. So if a Jew openly, brazenly says, I'm not keeping one of these laws anymore, he's lost his purpose in terms of giving charity to him. So if we look into the laws, we'll see that there are other considerations why there may be more severe penalties. Not because the crime is any worse for one or the other, or there's some inherent good that the Jew has. So even if he kills by accident, he's got a pretty severe case too. Even though he's not killed, he has to now go to one of the cities of refuge. Albeit he's not being killed, but that accidental killing is not representative of a abandonment of the minimal system. Where if a Gentile would, so that now shows that even those seven couldn't be held up. And I give the analogy that we hold more responsible an adult than a child, because the adult is now more. That's incumbent upon him. So just like a child, we're not going to punish the same way if an adult does the same action, so too, if we give a smaller system to the Gentile, and even that can't be held, those things are much more incumbent upon him. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. Now just Aurora has a question here, so let me just read it to you, because she typed it on the screen. She asks, if I'm driving my car at the right speed and someone suddenly decides without warning me that he or she is going to cross the street and there's no way I can predict that he will do so, and he gets killed under my car, I have not demonstrated the inability to serve the seven Ohad laws because observing implies free will. Okay, so she's asking like this. If you're driving your car and you're going the correct speed, and out of nowhere, somebody jumps out. Now, I could see two different cases, one where there would be some negligence and one where there would not. I can't. I mean, in all cases, there is going to be negligence, Aurora, because if you really want to protect human life, you will not be driving at a speed in any situation where you can't stop in time if somebody comes out in front of you. So, for example, on a highway, there are cars all around. There's no way a person can cross in to get into your lane just by walking. So you justify driving at speed. But let's say you're on a local street. Now, the speed limit may be, 20 miles an hour. But if there's a possibility that as you're driving past a car, there was a child that was ducked down in front of the car that you couldn't see, and his ball flew out of his hand, and he jumps out to get his ball, and you hit and kill the child, there's still negligence, because that is something which could be anticipated. A person's hunting in the woods and he kills somebody, that is not without guilt, because if a person is really concerned about human life, he will make sure 100% nobody else is in his firing range. The only reason you can kill somebody is because it was some negligence. However far fetched the possibility is, if there is an element of possibility that I can hurt somebody right now, so now there's negligence if I actually do hurt them. But if I take 100% care to make sure that I'm in a gated area, nobody can get in, and I want to do my hunting there, so it's impossible that a person would be killed because there's no way a person can get in. So there is always a certain negligence. And it's funny that Maimonides actually says those words. Let me just read them to you, because again, Maimonides was very precise in terms of codifying laws. And he says as follows, when he talks about a Gentile that's killing and is even accidentally murdered for it, not murdered, but is killed as a punishment for it, he says that a ger toshev, a Gentile, righteous Gentile, that kills an Israelite by accident, even though he did it by accident, he is killed. Then he says three words. Man is always... in Hebrew, it's other mood olam, which means that man is always responsible. It's very interesting how he just throws that in there. Meaning he's trying to tell you that any type of accidental death which comes on your hands is not purely accidental. And I'll give you a very beautiful insight that Rabbi Chaid gave. The law is that if a Jew would kill by accident, he has to dwell in the cities of refuge until the high priest dies. The question is, what does a high priest dying have to do with him leaving? A guy kills by accident, so he goes to the cities of refuge, he has to leave his town, and he has to remain there until the high priest dies. So Rabbi Chait said an insight that I had never ever seen, and it was just really brilliant. He said that what will happen now to this person when he's in the city of refuge is what? What's going to be going through his mind? What's the one wish that he has? He wants to get out, right?
Right, he wants to get out.
And how is he going to get out?
By if the high priest dies.
So what is he wishing for?
Well, then it puts him in conflict, because a great person like the high priest has to die in order for his life.
Right. Rachid explained that what's going to happen, and again, every type of a punishment in Judaism is to try to be a corrective measure. So since the person who killed by accident is truly negligent to some degree, but he has not seen that in himself, and that's why he was able to kill by accident, because he wasn't aware of any type of unconscious motives. He wasn't aware of this element of his nature, that he has a certain amount of carelessness when it comes to human life. So since he really hasn't, a Torah system tries to bring that out and to educate him on that. So now that he's wishing for the high priest to die, and this will be my ticket out of here, now he can start facing his own callousness. And he says to himself, what? I want the high priest to die? He's a great person? that will make him confront his wish for another human being to die. Meaning, however, he won't admit there's a wish, but he will now when he's, you know, he is anticipating at some level that the high priest dies, that hopefully will awaken in him that he had this type of a insensitivity towards human life, and that's why he was able to kill somebody else. And once he recognizes this in himself, he can do the true repentance. Now he could realize, oh, if I'm wishing for the high priest to die, that means there's something in me that maybe was existing a long time before and what caused me to kill somebody else accidentally. You see it?
Yes.
You see the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a very, it awakens in the person the very element that caused them to kill accidentally in the past. All right, so getting back to Hanukkah, so I guess we'll wrap it up over here. The idea itself of the oil being the method of the salvation could be, because this is what was trying to be stripped away from the Jews. So this is where God underlined the correct actions of Matthias' sons and the objective of reestablishing the Torah system, and that was by the first step of lighting the menorah, so the miracle was enacted in the menorah. And it could also be that the reason why we celebrate it today, okay, Aurora was just right and she understands a bit, for his household, the candles today. So I was thinking, why is that the formulation of how the commemoration of Hanukkah is? It could be because of the sun. And since the Torah, not the, death was not the initial problem with the Greeks, it was the Hellenization of the Jew. So the Torah was what's going to be lost. But now that we have it back, we embody the vehicle of transmission, which is the household, by lighting the candle for every household. So that could be why this is now the method by which the rabbis formulated that we celebrate Hanukkah by ner ish beiso, a ner for each man and his household. I mean, it's one candle for the entire household. The whole household now demonstrates in unison through the candle of the father, the commemoration. The father is the one that disseminates, that has the obligation of learning Torah and the obligation of teaching Torah. And that exactly what was at risk those years ago. Okay, any questions?
I don't think so, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay.
Very interesting.
All right. And again, so it's a good example how when God enacts the miracles, everything's done with precision for us to derive ideas from it.
Yeah, I must say I continue to be amazed at that precision.
Yes, it is. It is amazing stuff. Well, you're doing it with Rabbi Moskowitz with the Proverbs. That's an amazing book for that.
Yeah.
Every turn.
Very much so.
All right, then. All right, well, I'll let you go into the other class with Rabbi Moskowitz now. And then maybe we'll touch base during the week. Again, we'll
okay. Very good. And are we good for next week?
We're good for next week.
Excellent. We'll look forward to it.
Same here.
Thank you so much, and have a great week and a great introduction of Hanukkah.
Okay. Have a good week to both of you.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Be well.